I'm really pleased to have you a panel that's focusing on entertainment and music, because I'm an amateur musician myself, so it means a lot to me too. And it's especially appropriate, I think, that we're doing this here in Seattle, which is such a source of great creativity for the whole country in this field over the last decade. And I'm not sure that we would have had a blossoming of such creativity if it weren't for the fact that local bands got coverage on their local radio stations. So we're going to begin with John Sandifer, who's the executive director of the Seattle local of the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists. He's representing 1,200 broadcast performers and staff employees in this area. He's been in that position for 8 years, and he ran for Congress in 94. Before that, he has 36 years as an award-winning journalist in radio and television, including King TV. So he's got a distinguished career, and we're glad he could be here. We also have with us today Becky Brenner, who's the operations manager for KMPS-FM and KYCW-AM here in Seattle. And she's got 26 years of broadcasting experience, including 18 years in various programming positions right here in Seattle, including on air. And for 5 years running, she's been selected as one of the top 40 program directors in America. So glad to have her. David Meinert's here. He's a music impresario extraordinaire, and he's been shuttling me around town. I appreciate that. He's got his own company, Fuse Music, that represents some outstanding artists, and he's representing the Recording Academy, the local division of the Recording Academy of Arts today, and he just does a great job with some great bands and is a wonderful local legend here in the community. We also have Mark Allen, who's the president and CEO of the Washington State Association of Broadcasters. He's got 15 years of on-air experience at small and large market radio and television stations in Washington, Oregon, and California, including here in Seattle, in San Francisco, and the Los Angeles markets. So without ado, I'd like to begin with John, if you could, Mr. Sandifer. Thanks for being
here. Thank you, Commissioner, and good morning. As the Commissioner indicated, our union represents about 80,000 broadcast employees nationwide, 1,200 here in Western Washington, many of whom are regular employees of radio and television stations. I listened to the previous panel, and the question was, why aren't we getting coverage? It strikes me that as a television and radio news broadcaster with some 37 years experience, that the deregulation of radio broadcast rules is not a particularly sexy news story. Certainly not compared to a new flood on the Skagit River, or a nice orange house fire, or when there are considerations of terrorism and war. But, if broadcast ownership and control trends if those trends continue, aren't they potentially as important in terms of our basic freedoms as a medium-sized war in Iraq? When fewer people control more of what we see and hear, isn't that dangerous? And isn't that what has been happening? I don't know about you, but I think that many of us were not watching very well back in 1996 and beyond, as the local players were set aside and the big boys took over the playing field. I read an email day before yesterday that came out of Washington, D.C. at the commission level that suggested that everything that can be said has been said about this debate. We don't need hearings like this out there in Seattle, Washington. There are 15,000 documents on file with the FCC, and there is nothing new under the sun. But, Commissioner Powell, there is this. Today, we are more aware, we are watching, and we do have an opinion. And our opinion is, further deregulation is bad for local ownership, it's bad for local audiences, it's bad for local employees, and it's bad for our community at large. Please read our lips. The evidence is there. Look at what has happened to radio ownership in the Pacific Northwest, with specific reference to the two largest markets in the Northwest, Seattle and Portland, Oregon. There are 47 radio stations that have enough audience to show up on an Arbitrend ratings survey in those two cities, and 33 of them are owned by the three largest conglomerates in America, Clear Channel, Intercom, and Infinity. That's 70% control of the music we hear, the entertainment, the news, the advertising. What happens when they have 80%, 90%? Doesn't that scare you? Local owners have lost control of local broadcasting. Look at the television scenario here. We have all but one of the local commercial television outlets owned and controlled by large media giants, Cox, Belo, Tribune, Viacom. They do bring a lot to the table, but we have to balance what they bring with what they take away. Look at the news situation. The news on Kong is produced by King. The news on KCTS is produced by Como. The news on KSDW is produced by Cairo. The news on KTZZ-TV is produced by KCPQ. That's eight television outlets that could each have distinctive voices being programmed by four, by half that number, consolidation. KSTW-TV is an interesting and a most recent example. This was a separate and distinctive voice serving a geographic area. Entertainment, music, programming was directed towards Tacoma, South King County, Pierce County, and Thurston County. 5 years ago, it had a full-service news department that employed dozens of people. We represented maybe 25 of them. Then Paramount Viacom took over, bought the station, dismantled the news department, fired all of those people, went out of the news business and programmed Popeye cartoons or some syndicated programming. Well, last Sunday, this past Sunday, KSTW-TV went back into the news business, but without a department, without a staff, and without a distinctive voice. They're going to buy their news from another station. Why not? Four others do. Consolidation. And how does that serve the community? It's news that is already available to a Seattle audience. And while I'm at it, let me ask this question. Why do I need or want to see a young woman wearing swimming goggles dipping her face into a bowl of worms? I know the answer. Reality TV is cheap. You don't have to hire professional actors like the kind we represent, and it goes to the bottom line. As these corporations move more and more and concentrate on the bottom line and less on service to the community, employees have been reduced and repurposed. Employees who worked for one station a few years ago are now performing duties on multiple stations. One music department, one news department may serve three, four, five additional stations. There are fewer employees now and less local programming. An estimated 10,000 radio industry employees have lost their jobs since 1996. Whereas only two decades ago, most of the radio stations in Seattle had their own news departments. Today, and this has been said before, most radio stations don't have any news, and the music is homogenized, and your local announcer is in fact sitting in Denver. Competition for the remaining jobs has driven down wage standards. One talk show host told me, if you got fired by Intercom in Seattle, you've been fired by eight stations. I'm concerned with collective bargaining, of course, and where employees once negotiated with local managers who had some inkling about who these employees were and what their needs are, Today, these employees are talking to slick labor lawyers from out of town representing an unseen, all-powerful conglomerate that dictates terms and conditions and is only interested, it seems, in the bottom line. The product is supposed to have... Thank you. The product is supposed to have gotten better with these economies of scale. It's gotten worse. In radio and television, locally, any emphasis on public service, on providing audiences with variety and with the information they really need in a democracy, has been lost. It has given way to that frantic rush to capture and to keep audiences. The public, you, have been the loser. You hear less today about taxation, representation, education, and FCC rules, and more about car crashes, those house fires, and some little murders. You don't hear new and local musicians and their entertainment acts, and increasingly you're not even hearing local announcers. The corporations have dictated programming formats and have applied them across the board from station to station, from city to city. Fewer and fewer entities are controlling what we hear, and the public airwaves are no longer serving the public.
Thank you, Mr. Senator. I'd like to hear from Becky Brenner now. Thank you, Mrs. Brenner.
Thank you. I have a prepared statement, but in light of some of the comments that have been made this morning, I really would like to point out a couple of things about our stations, because I think it's important. We do community ascertainment. We have a news director who's been at our station for 27 years. We interrupted music programming for coverage of the 2001 earthquake in Seattle for local coverage. We also covered 9/11 very effectively, and there are hundreds of live community broadcasts that we do every year in the 6-county area that we serve. And I'm not on the localism panel, so I wasn't getting a chance to address all those issues, and I just wanted to point that out. And earlier this morning, a comment was made that, you know, people aren't enjoying what they're hearing on radio now. And a recent Arbitron study that was published only in the last 6 to 8 weeks found that radio listeners are very pleased with the programming choices available to them. More than two-thirds of the people, 69%, who were surveyed said that their local stations do a very good job of providing a wide variety of programming. And 75% of those radio listeners think that their stations do a very good job of playing the music that they like. So I just would like to say those things up front and then really address entertainment and music issues. Radio has been my passion for 26 years, as the commissioner pointed out. I started at 17 at Merrill High School, and it seems like there are a lot of Wisconsin alumni here. It's in Merrill, Wisconsin. And even though I was born in Seattle and lived here till I was 9, that was where my early radio career started. I actually do have the privilege of saying I was born here, and so I am a native. I've lived in Burien, just south of Seattle, since 1984. I'm an active member of the St. Francis of Assisi Parish. I volunteer as a coach and a teacher at the school and the church. I volunteer as pledge talent at the local public television station. I've hosted local United Cerebral Palsy and Arthritis Foundation telethons. I've been a member of the Puget Sound Radio Broadcasters, and many of the people on our staff have similar stories. They're local community people. Seattle's a great place to work. It's very competitive in the radio industry. And there are 57 commercial radio stations, according to BIA. There are 27 different owners. And back in 1996, before the ownership rules changed, there were 28 owners. So as you can see, the relaxation of the radio rules has not really affected the Seattle market. As the program director for the stations, I'm responsible for everything that you hear coming out of the speakers. I have final say over the music, the on-air talent, the station imaging, the commercial production, and I do get creative input from the music director, the marketing director, the production director, the on-air personalities. It's truly a team effort to make the station sound great. I've read articles recently that claim that radio formats today are not as varied as they have been in the past, and I don't agree with that statement. In Seattle, we have actually seen an increase in the format since 1996. There were 19 then, and there are 30 now. And 17 of these are brand new formats. Now, the rule changes have helped radio in our city. And For example, in 1996 in Seattle, there were 12 country stations, and we were all competing for the same audience. And there were multiple AC stations, there were multiple rock stations, all playing similar music, because each of their individual owners felt that they could win the ratings and revenue battle. And instead, what happened in many of those formats, you would have one clear leader and the rest of the stations picking up the scraps. Now today, the citizens in Seattle can choose from formats ranging from all news to sports talk. You have mainstream country, classic country, super hits of the 60s and 70s, album-oriented rock, album alternative, adult alternative. And as the group owners who have more stations to work with try to make every station more successful in their own right, niche formats emerge to provide even a greater diversity in radio for the listeners. Now, there is obviously some overlap in songs among these formats, but that doesn't mean that the diversity of music has decreased. It means that music can't be placed into neat little boxes. And a good example of that is Shania Twain, Faith Hill, and the Dixie Chicks. They all have very strong roots in country music, and yet they obviously appeal to a wide cross-section of listeners. That's why the Dixie Chicks and Shania Twain were invited to perform at the Super Bowl this year. And the listeners who ordinarily tune into adult contemporary formats and also those who listen to top 40 formats want to hear Shania Twain and Faith Hill and the Dixie Chicks. And in an era where the artists are all plumbing the depths of their shared experiences and their cultures, and they borrow from other cultures, music is bound to defy the neat little boundaries that have been placed on them in the past. And that's why the cable channel CMT, Country Music Television, they've had great success with a program called Crossroads. And it's a feature where they've paired Travis Tritt and Ray Charles, the Dixie Chicks and James Taylor, Alison Krauss and Steven Tyler, and they've had very successful shows. And right now, Kid Rock and Sheryl Crow are being played on country radio because they had the right song. The song is what really matters. And we can play country rock, country pop, country bluegrass, traditional country, and we do play all of them. It also provides a great deal of variety and diversity for the listeners. And our main goal is to serve our listeners and give them what they want. So I would hate to have the city of Seattle or the state of Washington or the federal government telling me what songs I have to play on KMPS or KYCW. And in fact, I wouldn't be happy if Infinity told me what to play. Now my two stations, along with KZOK, the classic rock station in Seattle, KBKS, the mainstream CHR format, and KYPT, the 80s station, and KYCW, the classic country station, we are owned by Infinity. But each one of our stations has its own program director, its own music director, its own on-air talent, and its own staff who run the station and respond to the citizen concerns and the requests. And I can honestly tell you that no one at Infinity has ever dictated a playlist to me. No one has ever told me I have to run a song on those radio stations. And what happens on our station is controlled completely by us, because Infinity knows that serving Seattle and the Puget Sound area is good business. And there's no one who knows how to do that better than those of us who live here and know the Northwest and make those decisions. Now, here's a good example of the local control and listeners actually driving the programming. In 2001, our sister station, KYCW, which served a niche audience with the classic country format from the 50s to the 90s, changed to extreme talk. Now, the listeners went nuts. I mean, we were deluged with emails and phone calls urging a return to the old format. And so a short 10 months later, with the will of the local listening public, it prevailed, and in a rare occurrence in radio yesterday or today, the station returned to classic country 1090. On KMPS and KYCW, we work hard to serve the listeners by playing music from a variety of artists. Some of those are signed to major labels, some to medium labels, some to small labels, and some have no label at all. And the goal is to find and establish the hit songs and then turn those into familiar songs that the audience will claim as their favorites. So that means we listen to about 20 to 30 singles every week. It's a minimum of 3 hours for our music meeting of the number of singles that are being considered for airplay. And because there are only 60 minutes in the hour, and our goal is to provide a good balance of the new music, the recurrent music, the gold music, we can add 2 to 3 songs every week. That's it. That's as much as you can expose to the audience so they can become familiar with it with reach and frequency. So that means it's, well, That's a lengthy artistic and scientific discussion we could get into on another day when we have about 2 hours to discuss that. But what it means is that there are a great many songs and artists that are never heard, and they're on the radio. That doesn't mean that they aren't exposed in other media, but they aren't on the radio. Now, this weekly routine has been the same since I started in 1977. It has not changed. And because the music business is so competitive and cutthroat, we do look for ways to expose local artists. The KMPS Morning Show airs a segment called Music from Our Own Backyard, featuring Seattle area and Northwest musicians. And on a recent segment, we played music from local community musicians like Myra's Tom and Klein, even a local R&B band called Bump Kitchen. And the band was so pleased that the song was aired on KMPS, their song Big Old Bones. They thanked KMPS on their website. They made note of the fact that they were blown away by all the entries on the site from the people who had heard their music on KMPS. Our morning man, Ichabod Kane, has been instrumental in exposure for local groups like the Coats and local artists like Duncan Shadrach, Jake Jefferson, and Jonathan Harris. We try to get these local musicians and some national and regional attention by occasionally sending material of promising local musicians to Nashville to the record labels that make it happen for the larger stars. And this past fall, KMPS worked with the USA Network on a television program called Nashville Star to find the best country singers and songwriters in the Northwest. And we had three local events moving toward that goal with more than 175 contestants that were vying for that one position to move on to the regional competition. We took the 10 finalists from those three local competitions and featured all of them on the morning show, did a local segment with that. So in conclusion, I would just like to say that in my experience, consolidation has provided us with some greater resources and a chance to raise the bar for many of the smaller stations who previously didn't have the kind of revenue or ratings to help them compete successfully. And in our own group, KZOK and KBKS have been more successful than they ever were under their previous ownership. The ability to share great ideas across the country and promote people within our own company has increased exponentially. And all of that has occurred while still allowing us to run our radio station like a hometown, locally owned radio station. And if we weren't focused on that, I truly believe we would not be as successful as we are. Thank you.
Thank you very much. If I could remind the remaining panelists that if you could stick to 5 minutes that were allotted for this, because we're running a little behind schedule. I'd sure appreciate it. David Miner.
Thank you. First, I want to say thanks for coming and doing this. I think it's no mistake that we have a president who wasn't elected wanting to do away with one of the main tenets of our democracy. I'd like to make a couple comments about Becky's comments. First of all, I think it's obvious that while there may be some great local radio stations, the radio market in Seattle is less competitive than it used to be before 1996, and if these rules are changed, it will be even less competitive. Also, an increase in formats does not equal more diversity. A good example of this is Shania Twain, Faith Hill, and the Dixie Chicks. Who are now getting played on over four stations that are called different formats in Seattle, but that are playing the same songs. So, enough on those comments. I want to talk about the local scene. I'm here only because the musicians that we asked to testify were afraid to testify because of fear of retaliation. So I have a bunch of letters from local musicians that I want to give to you. Here. There you go. And these people commented and wanted to comment, many of them anonymously, because they're afraid for their career. I, as well, represent several bands, and I'm afraid for their career because I'm testifying here. So hopefully it won't negatively impact them. So buy their records when they come out, please. You can go to my website. I've been a promoter for 11 years in Seattle, worked in the music business here since the early 90s. I used to work closely with several local commercial stations who were very invested in local clubs, local charities, and did local events at the venues in town. That has been happening less and less. since the 1996 Telecommunications Act and some of the national chains have come in and bought these local stations. A great example of what's happened to the local scene here is that between 1990 and 1996, several local bands from Seattle became major national bands: Nirvana, Soundgarden, Alice in Chains, Pearl Jam, the Screaming Trees, Sir Mix-a-Lot, Presidents of the United States of America, and everybody's favorite Candlebox. since 1997, since the Telecommunications Act and since Intercom came in and bought the three competing rock stations, not one Seattle band has broken as a major national act on commercial radio. And I think that pretty much says it all about the effect of... of radio consolidation. This has greatly harmed the local economy, the local musician economy. It's harmed local musicians' ability to make money nationally. It's harmed their ability to tour nationally, and also the people who work for them, like their managers, that can't make as much money, which is very sad. last year, I sat in the office of a local station music director, trying to get them to play a song off an album that I was involved with. During that time, one of the ad reps came in and said, "Hey, you know, this record label is trying to get the song played. What do you think?" And the music director said, "Get the money. If they don't give us the money, don't play the song. Make sure they know that." That's what's happening in radio. So I'll end there because I know we're short on time. So thank you very much.
Thank you, David. Mr. Allen.
Thank you, Commissioner Copps, Commissioner Edelstein. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I really thought maybe I would start at the back of my comments. I'll keep them short, but I want to make a couple of points first that were not in the prepared comments, which are now really out of date. The commission, and both commissioners know this, and I don't know whether the audience knows this or not, the commission didn't bring up the issue of ownership of radio, television, or media on its own. The radio industry, the television industry, the cable industry, the newspaper industry didn't bring up the issue either. It was mandated by Congress in the 1996 Telecom Act, which said deregulated radio ownership to a certain degree. And the commission, as a whole, has an obligation every other year to look at all of the ownership rules and justify on an empirical basis whether or not those rules should be retained. And that's what the commission is doing now. And I would encourage you, each one of you, to file a comment. It's very easy to do in the commission's proceeding. Go to the commission's website. There are instructions on how to do it. It's not fancy. It's you don't have to be lengthy or anything like that. Just file your comments. And I would encourage each one of you to do that. There are 15,000 comments that have been filed, and there are 285 million people. That, I'm sure, means one or two of the folks in the audience haven't filed comments yet. I would encourage you to do so, and I would encourage you to do a specific thing. I would encourage you to include in your comment, in whatever other comments you want to make, your idea of what your perfect radio station would deliver to you, and file that with the commission. The commission is asking for empirical evidence about whether the ownership rules have or haven't hurt diversity, localism, and competition. Part of what they need to know is what you want to hear. What would you like to see on TV? Make a list of subjects, programs, songs, kinds of music, discussions, issues, whatever. But send in your list to the commission so they can have an empirical basis to be able to understand exactly how it is the American people view the mass media, television, radio, cable, newspapers as well. That being said, I think we also need to dispel a rumor that's been allowed to float for the last several months, and that is that the radio industry is not promoting further deregulation of radio ownership rules. What we need to look at is not so much ownership rules, but at an underlying theory of why we do what we do today, how broadcasting is regulated today in the public interest. Now, the underlying assumption that over-the-air broadcasting is based on is about 80 years old, not quite, a few years to go yet. I'm not referring to the idea that the public owns the airwaves. We know that, it's accepted. What I am referring to is that a station can only serve the public interest, convenience, and necessity by being all things to all people all the time, every station. We hear a lot about productivity. It doesn't matter whether you're a corporation or a sole proprietor. We hear a lot about productivity. We've got to get productivity. The president has a productivity board. Everybody's working on productivity. How productive is having every station do exactly the same thing? That's not real productive. Now, this all things to all people paradigm was appropriate when there were only a handful of radio stations in any city. And in many cities, they relied on stations at some distance to provide their only broadcast coverage. But today, the all things to all people paradigm neither reflects the expectations of the public that it's designed to serve, nor the marketplace. And I think we do need to bring ourselves back to the fundamental one of the fundamental principles of the way our broadcast system works as opposed to those in other countries where the system is owned by the government or owned or programmed as a non-commercial entity. We have the best of both worlds. We have non-commercial stations and we have commercial stations, and it's been that way since 1927. Now, if we want to go back and change that, that's not the discussion today. If we want to go back and make everything non-commercial and everything volunteer-oriented, and there's nothing wrong with volunteer-oriented stations, that's something for another day to talk about. And maybe we do want to talk about that. But that's not the discussion today. Now, let me hasten to add that this is not about doing away with the public interest standard. We've never shirked that responsibility. We've done it in our own way. Everybody has their own idea about what public interest, convenience, and necessity means to themselves, whether they're an owner of a radio station, whether they're a disc jockey, whether they're a news reporter, or whether they're a listener. Everybody has their own idea about what the public interest means. And that's exactly why I'm asking each one of you to send your email as a comment in this rulemaking proceeding to the commission and tell them what you think the public interest standard means. Then they can begin to sort that out, and we can all have a dialogue, which I think is more productive than simply talking about numbers of stations and percentage of ownerships and numbers of owners and consolidation. Those are all buzzwords, but they obscure the real issues. What we're talking about is the public long ago having abandoned the expectation that every broadcaster would serve every need of every listener, regardless of what else they found on the radio band. Out of necessity, the industry has followed the changing expectations of the public as best we could. Today, we view ourselves, as our listeners do and as the public does, as part of the larger community and part of many smaller communities as well. We all know we can't get a Pepsi at Starbucks. Now, we don't expect to hear in-depth news analysis on an alternative rock station. So what the commission really needs to do, Commissioner Copps and Commissioner Adelstein, is start taking a look at this worn-out all-things-to-all-people paradigm and bring the public interest standard into conformity with the expectations of the citizens it's designed to serve. We believe we have led the way with no guidance from the commission. We believe we serve the public interest with input from the public. We don't know what more we can do until the public tells us more, perhaps by submitting comments to you. Once again, thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. I have a question about an apparent sort of difference of opinion that I see emerging from the panel about whether local artists can emerge from the local radio scene here. Ms. Brenner, you noted that you play a number of emerging local artists on your stations, and Ms. Miner, you noted that you're having trouble getting your artists played on local radio stations. Could you expand on that?
Well, I think there's two very, very different reasons. One, I think I'm dealing primarily in country, so I'm dealing with the country artists and local country bands, and it's a choice of our station to choose to promote those. I can't speak specifically to the rock side, but one thing that would be interesting to do an analysis on, and I will say up front that I have not done this, but I don't remember, prior to the emergence of the groups that that he mentioned, I don't remember there being any really breaking artists from here. Jimi Hendrix, I mean, you have some of the big huge
Hart,
ones.
Queensryche, I mean, I could go on and on. There's a lot, basically.
And I think that part of what needs to be addressed is more the issue of whether the standard and the volume of music that comes into the radio stations to be exposed has changed. And that is something that no one ever addresses. I can't address the band that he took into the music director to ask them to play because I wasn't there and I don't know that format. But I can tell you again that I know the volume that I deal with our music director. The volume of music we get every week and the different standards of all of the different music, we have a thing we call the test track at 5 o'clock every Monday through Friday. We test many songs there and ask the audience, what do you think? What do you love? Do you love it? Do you not? Do you want to hear more of it? And it's a challenge when there is such a volume of really great music and musicians out there to get exposure for all of it. And I think that's a side of it that no one ever analyzes.
I don't, you know, getting a couple spins on a commercial radio station in off-prime spots doesn't break artists and doesn't generate revenue for the local community. The fact is that I believe on country radio, as on rock radio in Seattle, since consolidation has happened, there hasn't been a major act break from the Northwest. And I think that that's telling of the effect. I don't think that's because all of a sudden, since 1996, all the local bands don't write good songs anymore. I don't believe that. Like, I don't think the quality has gone down that much. I think what's happened is that it costs money to get played on the radio. When I talk to major label people who work songs to radio regularly, to get a song worked to modern rock radio costs an average of $400,000. What this creates is a scenario where a new artist, it's very expensive to break a new act. So labels aren't signing new acts. Radio's not playing new acts because labels aren't spending the money on radio that it takes to get a new act broken, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's a vicious circle. But consolidation furthers that effect, I believe.
Let me ask Mr. Sandifer and anybody else who cares to comment. I understand the number of disc jockeys that work for one of the very major radio conglomerates in New York are protesting right now the use of voice tracking by their particular corporate parent. I'm interested in finding out, is voice tracking being used in this market and to what extent, and how you think that affects the public interest in terms of either localism or diversity?
Well, with particular regard to localism, one of the key issues in New York, and I should say it centers in New York, and this is the so-called Keep Radio Live program. Does everyone here basically know what voice tracking is?
No.
All right, most of you do. Let me just quickly say, due to digital technology today, I can voice track an entire radio disc jockey shift here in just a few hours that can then be used to play on a consolidated radio company's stations in Denver, Chicago, Florida, etc. The protest by our union over that is that there are negotiations underway now to replace a number of disc jockeys and announcers in New York and allow their company to voice track. It eliminates jobs. That's the big one. But it also eliminates localism. What happens is very, very deceptive when you think about this. The announcer in Denver will be given a little bit of information about an FCC hearing in Seattle, or how the Space Needle looks today, or what the weather forecast may be next week, and he will put that into his material that he recorded in Denver, and it's supposed to sound to me in Seattle like, this is my local announcer. It's just lying to me, and I resent that as a listener. They are not serving me. So, in brief, we protest, and to the extent that we can collectively bargain against that kind of a practice, we will do so. But it is another indication of how consolidation can take the local out of local radio.
I want to make one quick point about the quality of songwriting. There's a local artist who this year won a Grammy Award, but also wrote you a letter complaining how she used to get radio play. And this is a non-rock artist, by the way, so I'm not talking about rock radio. She used to get radio play on several local stations and no longer does since the Telecommunications Act went through. But she won a Grammy, so she's a quality artist, but still can't get local play.
Thank you. Let me ask Mr. Brenner, I want to make sure I understand the position of the Association of Broadcasters. You said they were against further deregulation. You were talking just about radio, or were you talking about television too? I want to understand where you are in the various rules like TV duopoly and things like that.
Well, I didn't say we were against further deregulation. What I said was the radio industry has not proposed further deregulation of ownership of the industry, the rules. We're not proposing that. We're not supporting that. That's not part of the agenda. The TV 35% cap rule, we oppose increasing the 35% cap on television. Our board has not dealt with the TV duopoly issue, but if you were to ask me to take a guess, I think that if you look at the small markets, and actually I want to relate this to radio as well, because very often we think about radio or TV in the large markets in Seattle and Washington, D.C. and New York, really where the ownership relief is the current ownership rules, whether they're radio or television, have hurt stations most is in the smallest markets. We have struggling radio stations in markets where there are only three, and one is an AM-FM combo that's been in existence for decades. The third station in that market, radio station, and I'll answer the TV question in a moment. The third station in that market is struggling, has always struggled. It was a docket 8090 station. And the commission's rules prohibit the AM-FM combo that is successful and could support that third station financially and permit it to serve the public interest in a better way than it does now, prohibit that company from owning that station. So you have one struggling station that really doesn't have the resources or the ability to do the kinds of things that many people here have talked about today. And then you have the other two now. And the TV duopoly rule, I think, is much the same. Mr. Luigi talked to you about the kinds of things that they are able to do with their two stations. One of the things that they were able to do with their two stations in the 2000 presidential election was to telecast both the presidential debate and the Seattle Mariners playoff game at the same time. How can they do that? They have two stations and they can do that. And NBC gave them the opportunity to do one or the other. And so they did both. That's one of the benefits, one of the public dialogue benefits of a TV duopoly. But in the smaller markets, it's even more important. Not only are we dealing with ownership and whether or not the commission is going to take a look at some of the TV ownership rules, but we're trying to get these TV stations into the digital world as well. And each one of them is spending up to $10 million, whether they're in Yakima, Washington, or New York City, to rebuild an entire television station from the ground up. We have stations in this market, at least according to the last time they were sold, that aren't worth much more than that. So they're having difficult times, and we have some stations that have asked for and received, thank you, extensions of their construction permits for their digital television. So in the small markets, and particularly because of the conversion to digital television, the synergy makes a lot of sense.
Thank you. One final comment before this particular panel adjourns. I really have been more than a little concerned at the number of reports I've heard, what Mr. Minard was talking about here, with people who maybe feel somehow intimidated or that their careers are going to be at risk for speaking out. And I know that sounds overly dramatic, and there are probably people back at the commission that think I'm being overly dramatic in pursuing this issue. But we have got to find a way to make sure that those people will come forward and will talk. And there's really, I think, two options. One is to create the process within the commission, and I've asked our Office of General Counsel to pursue this, and we don't have a satisfactory response yet, where we can figure out how to protect the anonymity of people and still get them coming forward. It's not easy to do because this is an open proceeding and a public proceeding, so you have to be very, very careful. But it's an issue of such importance at such a moment that we simply have to find a way to do that. And then I guess the other way is just for all of us to make this a sufficient national issue, again, no matter what side of the equation you're on, but just tee this issue up so that people who might be reluctant to speak out will say, well, maybe this isn't just another biennial review. Maybe this is, after all, kind of the mother of all biennial reviews that's going to set the direction of our media landscape for a long time, and maybe this is my opportunity to do something. And I guess while I work internally trying to get a process going at the commission to do that, I would just urge all of you with contacts in the entertainment world to say to your colleagues and friends, maybe it's different this time. Maybe if we can make this a national debate and get people's attention, we can make a difference in the rules, because I think it's going to take some real profiles and courage for people to step forward to address the problem. With that, let me thank this panel, and let's give them a round of applause. It was good and a spirited and a lively debate. And I'm just going to suggest that instead of the 15-minute break that we have built in here, that we just take 5 minutes, because we're going to go through the next panel and then we want to get to the public comments and the open mic. So let's try to re-adjourn here in just 5 minutes, okay? Thank you. Yeah.